Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 22nd of September. It's all things political for this hour, and we'll be looking at the Wall Street bailout package, what form that may take, how it's playing with taxpayers. Are they paying for windfalls for those who are responsible? We'll also be looking at the first debate, which will take place this Friday, and what each presidential candidate needs to do to win your vote if he hasn't already won your vote. All things political this hour with two guests, and we'll have a ton of phone calls, I'm sure, because so much is going on with Wall Street and there are concerns about mortgages and foreclosures. Does this bill for Wall Street have to include Main Street in some way? And what will be the ramifications politically for all that's been going on financially? We have two guests with us this hour. Professor Daryl Paul is Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at Williams College. Professor Daryl Paul, hello. Thanks very much for being with us today.
I'm glad to be here.
And also joining us is Professor Mary Jane Lennon, Associate Professor of Economics at Providence College. We don't have her on the line yet, so we'll get her. So we'll get her in just a moment. So we start with you, Professor Paul. There seem to be rumblings among people who live on Main Street that these are windfalls for those responsible, and somehow whatever bill that's getting fashioned needs to do something about mortgages and foreclosures, or it just isn't going to play out very well politically. What do you say?
I think that's right. I think something that we've seen as the weekend unfolded is a lot of attention to the details, the specifics of this plan. And the more that people looked at the details, I think the more that people began to get frustrated, angry with it. And so that's something I think we didn't see at the beginning of this debate.
And we will still try to get Professor Lennon, and that line is not working, just so we let everybody know. They have a deadline of Friday to get this done. What's the timeline here?
I think that Secretary Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, wants to get this done as fast as possible. And the sentiment seems to be that the markets are so skittish that something needs to be done quickly. And so I think this is really a self-imposed deadline, primarily coming from Secretary Paulson. I think there is some debate about how fast this needs to get done on the one hand, but secondarily how fast it should be done, because lots of mischief could happen if people don't have enough time to really go through the details and have an opportunity to have their say, particularly coming from the Congress.
He seems to be getting a lot of kudos from both the Democrats and the Republicans on this. Is he the main guy?
I think that's fair to say, yeah. At first, it looked like it was a plan that both Paulson and then the Fed chair, Ben Bernanke, had put together. But all we've really seen is Paulson, and so he really seems to be carrying the ball on this. I don't think that there's really anybody else in the administration who's had anywhere near as much to do with this as Paulson.
Mm-hmm. The taxpayers, I'm sure, are asking the question, many of them are, how can you mess things up so badly and walk away with a $30 million severance package? Can the Congress and Paulson fashion something that would eliminate that kind of profit for running things badly?
I think they could, although when some of the Democrats suggested it, I believe it was over the weekend, Secretary Paulson suggested that that was punitive and that was something that was not acceptable. But I think that what people are going to be looking more at are the details of the plan rather than some simple add-ons. You know, should we punish the CEOs? Should we have, you know, some kind of bailout for homeowners of some way? But that there's a lot of kind of specifics of this plan that I think also people are beginning to look into rather than just kind of add-ons on the surface.
Mm-hmm. Let's try this other line now. Professor Mary Jane Lennon?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. We have you now. We've already talked a little bit about the meltdown, of course. Let me ask you the same question. Are there rumblings among those who live on Main Street that this plan that's fashioned needs to look at the severance packages of those who many say created the problem, and you just can't have people walk away with $30 million?
Well, certainly. I think there is the potential for backlash. However, as in the case of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, it is possible that if there's some, you know, really egregious abuse of this, that, you know, I think the authority will be given to Treasury to deal with that. I agree, though, with what I heard of your previous caller. Can you hear me now?
Oh, we hear you fine.
Fine. To have a wholesale attack, perhaps, on The executive pay at this point probably wouldn't be beneficial, and that I think Treasury Secretary Paulson would like as much flexibility as possible just to get this program going and deal with any of the excessive compensation perhaps later. It's not clear that in every case that some kind of action would be warranted anyway. I mean, CEOs do tend to earn their pay, so to speak. So we'll just have to see what happens. But I agree with him in the sense that I think a broader package is going to come forward. He'll be given some authority, perhaps, to investigate these particular compensation packages, and then he'll just, whether or not it's warranted, we'll have to see down the road somewhere.
Professor Paul, do you see true bipartisanship in action on this issue?
I don't know if I'd quite go that far. I think the plan began with a tremendous amount of fear among people in the Congress that this is truly desperate, and so we saw some newspaper articles from people in the Congress who had met with Fed Chairman Bernanke, met with Treasury Secretary Paulson, and those two had communicated how dire the situation was. I think particularly in the top ranks of both parties, we do see a lot of bipartisanship. But once we get under that top layer, I think we are beginning to see a lot more dissension. We see Republicans like Senator Bunning, who is from Kentucky and on the Banking Committee in the Senate, expressing some opposition to this. We also see some lower-ranking Democrats who are uncomfortable and starting to speak out. So I think the bipartisanship is mostly at the leadership level, and we'll see if they can keep this deal together.
Do you agree, Professor Lennon?
I do. And listening to Barney Frank just recently and his comments, I can see where this upper tier of policymakers see the urgency of the situation and are trying to deal with it. This is an election year, and as we all know. And that, I think, will perhaps inflame some of the rhetoric that gets thrown around as politicians, at lower levels, the non-policymakers, if you will, at this critical juncture, deal with the issue and answer their electorate. But I would hope, certainly, that the bipartisanship that has been exhibited so far within the Financial Services Committee, et cetera, will continue.
And what about the electorate, Professor Paul? We're very close now to an election. Does this play out beneficially for the Democrats or the Republicans, or is everybody mad at both parties?
I would say that there's probably a reason to be angry at both parties, although one would think, at least I would think, that this would be playing somewhat to the hands of the Democrats, and I think so for two reasons. One, it seems to have pretty definitively ended what I would call the silly season in politics. We don't seem to be debating over lipstick on pigs and Sarah Palin so much, but we're wrestling with some pretty serious issues. And so I think that the post-convention bump has been suppressed to some degree. So that's good for the Democrats. But also, the Republicans have traditionally been the party of lower regulation, and they have been in charge. They have had the presidency, and they have had the Congress since the mid-1990s. So if people are looking to malfeasance or people have not been essentially watching the store, they're going to have to look at the Republicans.
And Professor Lennon, can you blame this on the Bush administration for not minding the store? And the second question a lot of people have been asking is, why isn't the president more front and center on this issue?
Well, first of all, certainly there has been an enormous lag in the response of the administration. I mean, going back to last summer, there were all kinds of flags. Larry Summers of Harvard, other prominent economists were warning that this bubble in the housing market that had burst was going to have impacts all over the economy. And, they just weren't listened to. The administration really did take a back seat. You have a much more proactive, obviously, Treasury Secretary Paulson. I think that, things had to get bad enough, if you will, that this administration finally realized that, they had to give him the authority to move independently. And I really think, if we had a different Treasury Secretary at the moment, we might see a different response, because this administration has been loath to intervene in the financial markets. But this really was brewing well over a year ago, and that lag in addressing it in a more systematic fashion has put us where we are now. In response to the issue, I forgot your other question, the other part of the question.
I don't remember.
Yeah.
It's all right. The first part was just fine. We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We have two guests with us for all things political, and we're talking, starting, of course, with the bailout package for Wall Street. Our guests are Professor Mary Jane Lennon, Associate Professor of Economics at Providence College, and Professor Daryl Paul, Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at Williams College. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation, and we'll start taking your calls in just a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll begin taking your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number, and we'll start with Jim from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. Well, I, in a perverse sort of way, I'm glad that all of this is happening, because maybe you know, people will start to learn from this. In the first place, it seems to me that it's clear-cut that the executive branch of the government is supposed to enforce the law, and yet it's not enforced. God didn't give Moses a list of the 10 suggestions. And the Republicans, for once and for all, we should be able to show that the Republicans and the libertarians are dead wrong, because deregulation doesn't work. And, you know, in the whole process, the Republicans use the concept of the self-fulfilling prophecy. You say something's going to happen, then you do the things to make it happen, and then piously say, "We told you so." They say the government doesn't work, they sabotage the government, and then they piously say, "Well, government doesn't work," when they set up the conditions for the government not to work. So if we're going to deal with all of this, we have to elect somebody who's going to enforce the laws, and we have to punish people that break the laws. And having worked in the prison system, you know, if you really want to get the laws, the impact of prison, to have an impact, you've got to send the white-collar criminals to maximum security prisons. You don't send them to a country club prison where, in minimum security, where they're on their best behavior. Everybody's on their best behavior because they know that they're going to get out soon. So, you know, it's just very basic. The laws are there. They ought to be enforced.
Thanks, Jim, for your call. Professor Lennon, you want to start?
Well, I do think that, in fact, getting back to the political issue and tangential to what your caller just said, that the party in this case that can do a better job of explaining to Main Street what has happened, where there has been malfeasance, perhaps, and where some of this, you know, there are firms that are being taken down that have done nothing wrong. There are CEOs who, in essence, have purchased assets or invested in assets that really should not be underwater at this point, that should not be so illiquid. So there's a lot of sorting out that has to take place here. But in a political perspective, that party or that candidate who can do a better job of explaining this to the American electorate, I think will definitely have an advantage, because there is so much confusion about what the cause of the problem is, what the consequences of dealing or not dealing with the problem would be. And, you know, it's an education process, and it's very complex. It's not as simple as somebody's guilty, somebody's not guilty. These are situations that must be dealt with swiftly. And if we can say one thing about our officials, is that at least now that they've started to act, they are acting more rapidly. If you take the case of Japan, for example, when their real estate bubble burst and they had their financial crisis, they did not deal with the situation, and consequently they had, they were in recession for over a decade.
Professor Paul, has either Obama or McCain explained this to Main Street in a way that we can all understand?
It seems to me that they're still waiting a bit and feeling out the situation. It's difficult, I think, for the candidates to jump in, just as we've seen it's been very difficult for members of Congress to jump in and get a handle on this. So much of this seems to be immersed in all the technicalities of various kinds of financial instruments.
Yes.
And the complex intertwinings of all these firms. And so it feels to me, at least, like the candidates are waiting a bit. But what they need to do is at least have a posture of attitude towards this process. And I think that's where the candidates are trying to be careful about that attitude, to try to be angry or upset and have a sense of justice that needs to be done. But at the same time, I guess I would agree with Professor Lennon and disagree a bit with Jim, your caller, in that it doesn't strike me that this is really a question of illegal acts. Certainly, probably some illegal acts have been done, but I don't know that it's a question of enforcing laws, because so many of the things that were done that allowed this, these processes, these bubbles to explode so much, were done legally.
I know that foreign policy is supposed to dominate the first presidential debate this Friday. Are they going to change course, Professor Lennon, and talk about – I don't see how they can't. I'm not sure how you make it a part of foreign policy. Both are important, but this is what's on everybody's mind.
Well, certainly there are international repercussions from the credit crisis that, mm-hmm. you know, has emanated from the United States. And in part, I think, you know, we have a lot of support out there for the actions that are being taken. I think there's a bit of amazement, too, that the U.S. is moving swiftly now. And in that sense, you know, there is this obvious interrelationship. In terms of the rest of the foreign policy agenda, I think for the moment that's going to take a back seat. Of course, until the next headline. We heard almost nothing about the embassy bombing that took place last week in Yemen, and that just goes to show you that, except for a couple of comments by the Bush administration, all eyes are on the financial markets with this meltdown, and there's no other way to describe it but as a meltdown. And so to answer your question, yeah, I think that the economy and the financial crisis will be front and center unless things stabilize very quickly.
Let me ask a simple question, but there must be others who have a simple question here, Professor Paul. This meltdown has been described as one of historic proportions, that everything could have just totally tumbled if there had not been an offer of a federal bailout. Do you agree with that?
It certainly seems to be the case. It would probably be a very reckless move to say one should do nothing, but certainly compared to what Secretary Paulson and Chairman Bernanke were doing, which is sort of putting out little fires here and there, that didn't seem to be solving anything. And so some kind of big response was likely necessary. What the details of that response are, I think, can be and should be debated. But if we think of, say, the S&L savings and loan bailout of the 1980s and early 90s, I mean, that came to ultimately about $125 billion that were charged to the taxpayer. We're talking now not just with the $700 billion that Secretary Paulson is suggesting, but the $200 to Fannie and Freddie, the $85 to AIG, the $29 to Bear Stearns back in March. Not that all of this is going to be lost, but we're already up to over $1 trillion. So this is of astounding proportions. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
May I say something to
that?
Oh,
of course.
Yes, that's the upfront price tag on all of this. But if indeed, I mean, these assets that are illiquid currently should have value. And if the federal government can unwind these assets as they acquire them over time, there is a very good chance that this should cost U.S. taxpayers much less than the price tag. I'm not saying it won't cost anything. But, of course, if you remember the long-term capital situation in the 90s when essentially the Fed acquired the entire assets, it didn't end up costing taxpayers a penny, not a penny. Nor did the, well, of course, it's not a completely analogous, but the Chrysler bailout. Chrysler ended up paying its loans off early, and it cost taxpayers nothing. To act now in the long run, could in the long run actually reduce the total cost in terms of foregone tax revenues if we don't slip into a severe contraction. And it is a risk, there's no doubt about it. But it's very likely that these assets, once this financial panic is over, these assets should be able to be sold. And like the savings and loan situation, and the government recoup a great deal of what it will have to borrow in order to make this happen.
And when you talk about the long run, you're talking how long?
When I speak of the long run, you know, these assets will probably take, 2 to 4 years, perhaps, to unwind. And I'm not talking decades, but they clearly should have value, because not everything that's in there is in those assets, no matter how they're packaged, is worthless by any means. And so I'm more, in that sense, I'm more optimistic about the outcome of this intervention, because I do think that when some stability is brought to the market, many of these assets will regain their value. If you look just at what has happened in the muni market, the bonds issued by state and local governments, who have the power to tax, they are illiquid as well, and there's no good reason for it other than fear, the fear that anything that is being marketed that has these debt obligations associated with it are worthless. And so once we get that moving again and we can remove that fear, then it should be these assets should regain their value, and that's the hope here.
Are you optimistic about the long run here, Professor Paul?
Maybe not quite as optimistic, but I think some of it depends on whether this is fundamentally a liquidity crisis and we just need to sort of get the ball rolling again, or whether this is a solvency crisis and these assets really aren't worth much of anything at all. It seems that the housing price drop is going to continue over the next year or perhaps longer. We have unemployment rising. We seem to be clearly going into a recession. And so this may have more important knock-on effects in the future for the value of housing. And so the value of these assets that the federal government is going to be buying is very much dependent on what happens in the future, which seems dark in the near future at least. But it also depends on how much the federal government is going to pay for these things. If the federal government pays a lot for them, the chances of the taxpayer bill in the end being high are great. If the federal government pays very little for them, then the taxpayer won't be stuck with as big a bill. But as yet, because Secretary Paulson has basically presented a plan where he has a blank check to do as he wills, no one really knows what ultimately the final tally, the final bill for this will be.
John is our next caller. Hi, John.
Hi. I'd like to give the perspective from an independent voter on this. Originally, it was President Clinton that repealed Glass-Steagall, that was a wall of separation between commercial bankings and these Wall Street shenanigans, which has made a lot of this possible. Then we go to Democrat U.S. Representative Charlie Rangel from New York, whose job in the Congress is to basically oversee the IRS. He's just admitted he's been engaged in illegal tax evasion now for many years, and he won't retire from his seat. Then Barney Frank, Democrat, U.S. Congress, is the chairman of a banking regulatory committee, essentially. He's been accepting large campaign contributions from the banking industry, so he's been kind of like a bump on the log as far as banking regulations. The same is true of Democrat U.S. Senator Christopher Dodd, who's similarly a chairman of a banking committee in the U.S. Senate, has been very quiescent over the years as far as supervising or regulating banking. Then last of all, you have U.S. Representative Democrat Charles Schumer from New York City, who's going around telling the hedge fund managers not to worry when Obama says he's going to increase their taxes. Schumer says either he can block that in the Congress, or if any tax increases do happen, they'll be so minuscule that the hedge fund dealers won't have to worry about it. So you have the head of the Democratic Party talking one way, and you have these powerful Democrat committee chairmen in the Congress doing exactly the opposite.
So you blame do you blame the Democrats for all of this, John?
Oh, no. Whenever you have a crisis of this proportion, both political parties, by definition, are in it up to their necks.
Okay, let's go to Professor Lennon first.
I'm not quite sure how to respond to the caller, other than to say that the deregulation of our financial industry actually began well before 1980, but it was the Deregulation Act of or Monetary Control Act of 1980 that began this process. It has not been a single administration that began this, and in fact, it has been a continuation of deregulation that has happened throughout our economy. And it's one of those fine lines that government has to walk. Too much regulation and you stifle economic growth. Too little regulation and you do leave the door open to excesses. And so clearly there are places where more regulation, probably more transparency, but more regulation may be needed. However, I would not throw the baby out with the bathwater and suddenly return to the regulatory environment that we had post-World War II, post-Depression. The world has changed. Financial complex financial instruments are necessary in order to provide adequate liquidity to an economy. And so while refining the system is certainly something we want to do, I also would be loath to just start re-regulating. In some sense, the response to the Enron and other excesses we saw in the last several years resulted in marking to market. And in some cases, some of these financial institutions, because they're constantly forced to write down the value of their assets in this panic, it's exacerbating the situation. So a regulation that came with Sarbanes-Oxley, good intentions, but we do have to be careful not to overregulate, not to introduce into the system changes that then further constrain the ability of these institutions to do their job. People are forgetting that we can't have a modern economy without a financial system that, you know, extends credit and provides liquidity that we need. That's not to say that everybody's off the hook, but it is not as simple as just saying, well, let's turn back the clock.
What do you think about regulation, Professor Paul?
Well, I think in terms of John's question and the role of the particular Democrats that he was talking about, certainly both parties can be seen to be partly at fault or at least contributing to this matter. The Democrats have only been in control of the Congress, though, for the last year and a half, whereas the Republicans have been in control of the Congress since 1995, at least in recent terms. So in terms of looking at what parties are more responsible, I would think that the Democrats have a better opportunity to make their case. It's going to depend a lot, though, on what the Democratic leadership in the Congress does vis-a-vis Paulson's plan. If they essentially give Paulson everything he wants, I think people like John are going to probably be more angry at the Democrats. But to take a step back from a sort of Democrats versus Republicans position, I think that this situation, if it does look like a big bailout for the financial industry and a giant bill being delivered to taxpayers, that more independent voters, I think, are likely to be out there, and they're likely to be more angry. And so we can think of something like the SNL bailout, which preceded a run for the presidency by somebody like Ross Perot. And we should remember that Perot won, I believe it was 19% of the vote in 1992. And so we may be fueling a sense that pox on both your houses.
Right.
Both of these parties are so invested with the power of Wall Street that neither of them may be able to represent the interests of other people.
Let's go to an email from Bruce from Vernon County. Could your guest give us a simple explanation of what would happen if we did not go forward with his bailout? The administration says the circumstances would be dire. People use the words catastrophic, collapse is imminent, etc. But what does this mean in simple English for the little guy, for the economy? You won't find much sympathy for the bigwigs on Wall Street or for the asleep at the switch administration. Why should we bail them out? Professor
Lennon? That's a good question.
It is a good question. So what's the answer?
Well, the answer is this. If you want to, and it's funny, I spent some time talking about this in my class just this morning. Not wishing to bail out the bigwigs, perhaps, you also don't want to end up hurting Main Street, where jobs are created, et cetera, et cetera. The problem, if you look at just what happened in the financial markets on Wednesday, which really forced the Treasury to act as it did Thursday night and Friday, there was a total meltdown in lending. Banks stopped lending to one another. There was a massive flight into treasuries. All you had to do was look at the return on the 2-year treasury was paying almost zero. That flight into safety in treasuries reflected the absence of credit available to homeowners, businesses, students, so that the small business owner who borrows perhaps to pay for his inventory and therefore hires people, you know, that multiplier effect, he won't find it there. And one of your previous callers said something about the home market, the housing market, I think they did. You know, contractors are not going to be able to build new homes and employ people unless there's mortgage money out there. It's no coincidence that new home starts fell to a 17-year low just in the past, in July. That's because there's no credit out there. Without credit, kids can't go to college. That market has been affected. Households can't borrow for automobiles, for homes, etc. Small businesses can't finance their payrolls, their purchases of computers or whatever it is. And when those things don't happen, then you get layoffs. If you think unemployment is bad now, then associated with a financial collapse or freeze would be a much greater increase in unemployment.
Professor Paul?
I think Professor Lennon's basically right. But what I'd like to take out of that is to highlight the power of the financial interest and the financial sector vis-a-vis our economy. The Detroit automakers have come to Washington, and they're asking for $25 billion. Unfortunately for the automakers, the financial industry is just far more important to our economy than the auto industry. And so, at least in political science, we would use a term like structural power. The financial industry has a tremendous amount of structural power. If we don't give them what they want, we all suffer. If we don't give Detroit what it wants, well, we're all going to suffer a lot less. Some of us might not suffer at all. And so that is the situation that our economy is in. But that being said, I think we can't ignore the kinds of concerns that a lot of regular people, the kinds of people who are calling into the show today, have about questions of justice, questions of equity. I think if we just simply leave it at, well, this is just good for the material interest of everyone, and we ignore these other matters, then there's going to be potentially some serious political backlash as people get angry over the kinds of responses that we're going to make. And I think responses in some way have to be made, but
right,
then we need to think about the details.
Well, it's interesting, and tell me how we go about deciding who we're going to help, because both of you who have students, I'm sure, and probably many students who have tens of thousands of dollars in student loans, why don't we help them? How do we choose who we're going to help?
I think in some sense we are. I mean, there have been a number of lenders who have had to drop out of the student loan market with the changes in the availability of credit. And to some extent, you know, the Department of Education is stepping up and expanding its loans to students. So I think that the federal government is going to try to deal with that. I do think that this, and I agree with Professor Paul, that there has to be more equity in the solutions that come forward. I think that's part of what he's getting at. And certainly, as we look toward helping the financial institutions with their illiquidity, it's also seems to me that more has to be done to help homeowners who find themselves in these terrible positions of having adjustable rate mortgages, for example, that reset at interest rates that they can no longer afford. And yet, for example, they find it so difficult either to refinance or the costs of refinancing are prohibitive. So there are things that Congress can do there, and I think some of the certainly some of the congressional Democrats are looking for more attention to the homeowners who are also illiquid at this point. And I would agree with Professor Paul.
Thank you for the promotion.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if that's a promotion.
I thought you might say that.
But certainly I would agree with him that, you know, as time permits, these kinds of issues should be addressed. They should have been addressed sooner. But having said that, you know, it's the analogy that if you have a city that's built of wood, because you either have an arsonist or perhaps someone who's just been negligent, you don't let the whole city burn down because you don't want to put that person's fire out. What you do is, you know, you take care of the emergency, the crisis, which is what I'm advocating at this moment. And then certainly you look for the guilty parties as well and try to come up with a better environment for everyone's safety.
I think also we have this question of should we bail out this sector, should we bail out that, should we deal with homeowners who are underwater on their loans, should we deal with students with student loans. I think we also have a bigger question behind that, which is can we? I mean, can we essentially, can the federal government wave a magic wand and fix everything. We have the sense that the federal government, Bernanke, Paulson in particular, have an ability to make things happen. And I think the frightening question behind that is, what if they don't?
Let's go back to phone calls. We go to Marion from Crystal Lake. Hi, Marion.
Hi.
Hi.
I think your people are absolutely wrong in the idea that executive compensation and golden parachutes are not an issue. As I don't know anybody, literally no one, who isn't absolutely furious about this sort of thing. As far as I'm concerned, any monies that are available after a basic rescue, you need to do something to fund pensions and make them not pension funds unavailable to corporate raiders. You need to pay your debts, and you need to put corporate parachutes absolutely and completely and totally dead last. I would also like to see some sort of tie-in that encourages companies to do some kind of long-term investing and not only worry about how high their quarterly profits are. You know, slow and steady works. But what they do is people get greedy. They want everything right now, and this is what we have. And that's my comment.
Thank you, Marion, for the call. Professor Lennon.
Well, I didn't mean to imply that in all situations every CEO is entitled to whatever golden parachute he or she may have negotiated. And in fact, I said that when the smoke clears and the crisis is passed, then the Treasury Authority, whoever the supervising body ends up being over this quote-unquote bailout should have the authority to perhaps make adjustments. And in fact, I cited the Fannie Freddie case where the executives of those two companies did lose a significant portion of their compensation and their golden parachute. So I didn't mean to imply that nothing should be done there. You just have to be careful in making blanket statements because about who should suffer and who should not in terms of what exactly the extent of the bailout is and what companies are affected. That was my only point there.
Professor Paul.
If the Democrats are going to focus on things like golden parachutes, I think they will end up settling for some pretty weak tea in return for giving what could be an enormous bailout to the financial sector. So it's not to say that the golden parachute question is not important. I think it is. It's symbolic to some degree. I think it comes into these questions of justice and equity, which are important. But if the Democratic Party is going to focus on these things, I think they're focusing on the sidelines. They're focusing on the things that are not nearly as central to this issue. They should be worried less about whether an executive is getting a $20 million golden parachute. They should be much more worried about how do we protect the taxpayers from what could be an enormous amount of money.
We'll pause for just a moment and return. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest for all things political, Professor Daryl Paul, Associate Professor, Department of Political Science at Williams College. Professor Mary Jane Lennon is Associate Professor of Economics at Providence College. And just so you know, I'm aware, you have five more minutes, right, Professor Paul? And then
That's
you have
right.
to go to class. Okay. Let's go back to phone calls, and we go to Tom from Burlington next. Hello, Tom.
Yes, my name is Boyle, and I live in Burlington, and they're starting to lay off a big employer in my town here because they can't get the financing. On the radio show on Meltdown Monday, last Monday, I said that we had to bail out the banks, the borrowers, as well to maintain confidence. It was very, very important to me that we do that. I studied economics at Georgetown. But if we look at the timeline between the candidates and the political effect, Mr. Obama and Mr. McCain, neither of them on Sunday said that we should bail them out, and they flip-flopped, and this even the inconsistency itself is very, very bad for the markets. And when you talk about the Wednesday bottom fell out of the thing, the financial markets around the world are realizing that our two candidates that we put up there really know nothing about economics. And then in 18 months ago, when 2 million people began losing their houses, Biden, Obama and McCain were sitting in the Senate at the center of power on the seat of their pants, and they did nothing to help the homeowners, and they could have stopped this many, many months ago if they had just been aware of what was going on.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Somebody should have been aware of what's going on, Professor Paul, shouldn't they? I mean, you could blame everybody for this, but...
To some degree, I think you're right. There are stories about Fannie and Freddie with a tremendous amount of political power, and so lobbied Congress in a way that made them very lightly regulated. There are, I think, very interesting questions about the role of Phil Graham, and who is the major advisor on economics to Senator McCain in some of his enthusiasm for deregulation. And so I think that there are lots of reasons to be suspicious about the role of the Congress and the role of politicians. But on this question of confidence, I think that seems to be the primary goal here. And every time that either Secretary Paulson or Chairman Bernanke would do something, everyone was looking towards whether it would instill confidence in markets. And it feels a little bit like a very dangerous game that people ended up playing in 1997 with the Asian financial crisis. And if the goal is to instill confidence, this potentially is a real losing game for anybody who's not needing to be placated, because their ability to become confident may be dependent on infinite amounts of resources given to them.
Thank you so much, Professor Paul. Please join us again. Have a good class.
Good morning to you, and thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. Professor Lennon, you want to respond to that as well?
Well, I will say, and again, I'm not the politician here or the political scientist, but I have been watching Congress over the past year, and I will tell you that Barney Frank, since he became essentially chair of the House Financial Services Committee, was working very hard on legislation to deal with the foreclosure issue. If we remember what was at the heart of all of this, it was the housing bubble, then the foreclosures, which began to sink these assets, if you will, and sink households along the way. And he was working very hard, trying to get the Bush administration and the other Republicans in Congress to deal with the foreclosures that now, you know, have really are the triggering mechanism for this current financial crisis. The loss of faith in these assets comes because the underlying mortgages have failed at historically high rates. So I wouldn't be entirely satisfied saying, well, Congress has been asleep. There have been people out there working on this. And he's had Republicans join with him. Nothing really got done in a substantive way. It was much too slow. Congress typically is too slow. I mean, let's face it. The legislative process with 435 members, each adding their own favorite line to a bill, is a very slow process, unfortunately. And so instead of having proactive responses, we end up with reactive. And that's what, of course, has had to take place over the last couple of weeks.
Steve from Eau Claire is next. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment. I've served on a bank board for a number of years, and I think one concept, both with banking and corporate, is that there are boards that often don't really take any kind of a role in watching things and searching into things and asking the hard questions. And I think what we've seen is a real situation of greed getting totally out of hand, which is usually followed up by stupidity getting totally out of hand, and we're all paying for it now. And one of the most upsetting things, almost a year ago now, I wrote a paper, and I submitted it to our board and our bank president, and I also submitted to the UW School of Business, describing a lot of what this is. And I come down to the bottom line. I'm a contractor from northern Wisconsin. If I could even get a glimpse of some of this coming, where was everybody? Where was Congress? Where was the administration? Where were the bureaucrats? And what I'm a little afraid of is they say that the Republicans' floodgate of money is oil, and the Democrats' floodgate of money is banking and finance. And I'm a little afraid, and I've never believed this in the past, but I'm afraid that we have the situation in our government right now that the only thing that will start to cure this is term limits.
Professor Lennon.
Actually, I hadn't, you know, term limits is not a topic or a subject that I've thought about a lot lately. There is, you know, clearly some advantage, I suppose, not having individuals who accumulate lots of ties to lobbyists, et cetera, or owed favors or whatever. On the other hand, you do limit the ability of the public to elect whom they want, and that's always been part of our congressional history. The other issue, too, is that some of these people become very experienced at the various areas that they deal with. I do think, though, that with the scrutiny that has to come, we do need more nonpartisan, more objective regulation in the bodies. Not so much, you know, we expect the Congress to be a political body. We don't expect the SEC or the Fed, which it is not, behaving politically. And so I guess what we have to do is make sure that in future administrations, these oversight bodies, these regulatory bodies, are truly staffed by experts in their field and not, you know, political hacks, if you will.
Professor Lennon, can you give us, this is such a day-to-day thing and it's so much explosive news, can you give us a feel for where we're going with all of this during this week?
Oh, boy. That's a tough one. We're always, you know, I hardly sleep these days waiting for the next shoe to fall, to drop. But, you know, big news last night with the two remaining powerhouses in investment banking seeking bank holding status. In some sense, there are major shifts on Wall Street that are going to be very long lived. A lot of, de facto, some of the structure of the banking and the commercial lending industry, et cetera, is changing shape before our eyes as these institutions begin changing shape. And the fact that Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs now will be bank holding companies immediately makes them subject to more regulation. That should add, you know, some more stability, et cetera. There are lots of advantages and some disadvantages for the firms, but we're seeing Wall Street change in front of us so that, as many have said, the Gilded Age of finance may be over. I'm not quite sure I believe that, but having said that, in terms of the coming week, we have to see how Congress treats this package put forth by Paulson. There will clearly be some more limits in it, but the financial markets are waiting for signs that indeed, you know, something of the sort that has been proposed is going to be possible. In the absence of that, there'll be, you know, further distress on Wall Street. So it's really up to the Congress and the Treasury now to hammer out a proposal that the financial markets can have confidence in, that the government can execute, and that the American public can have faith in.
Thank you, Steve, for your call. Tom from Green Bay is next. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. My comment is our parents from the Depression have values of saving and being frugal. And the problem with America and the problem with Wall Street is, and our president even reiterated this, is we want to spend, buy to keep our economy going. And the greed that's encompassed in this has basically clouded the sound judgment to make good investments, sound investments, and not make quick trading investments. And I would like to see is let everything fail and let it rebuild itself. Conservatism proliferate by changing the values of America and how they perceive buying things. Buying what you need, not what you don't need, to keep the economy going.
Professor?
Well, I'm not sure who's going to define what we need and what we don't need. I do think that the statement that to let everything fail is a rather strong statement. I mean, one only has to look at financial history to see the hardship that the everyday family suffers when, quote-unquote, everything fails. The Depression, clearly the worst case example, but the effects of letting everything fail are catastrophic. So I'm not sure that's a solution either. In fact, I'm certain it's not. And my humble opinion would be that we need to seek economic stability. There has to be some kind of stability. Otherwise, jobs disappear and people suffer terribly. And it ends up in affecting our long-run growth over the long run, over a generation, et cetera. We want to see rising living standards. I don't know if that's greed or not. People want better education. They want better homes. I think it's human nature. But in order to have those things, you have to have a strong economy. To have a strong economy, you have to have good government. You have to have strong institutions. And, you know, that's what we're working on. Clearly, there's been some failures. But the failure to act, I think, would be much more catastrophic. I do agree with our policymakers on that.
Professor Mary Jane Lennon, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Professor Lennon is Associate Professor of Economics at Providence College, and we also thank Professor Paul from Williams College Department of Political Science for joining us for All Things Political this Monday, the 22nd. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and to Katie Madsen for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we will return with another hour of our Monday morning talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.